So as I present myself, so thank you very much for turning up, giving up the time. And as Graham says, I'm going to be speaking today. So you'll be familiar with the title, obviously, but the work I'm speaking about today draws on not long back from the States. Very much thanks to Fulbright Commission that allowed me to do work over there for 8 months. So it's drawing on a whole load of research. This is just one of the first papers that's coming out of it, but hopefully I'm going to get a book out of it as well. So huge thanks to them, of course, as well. Wouldn't be able to do it without that. And a brilliant opportunity. I know there's one colleague in the audience who's going to be part of it this year, so going to love it. So it's a great thing. I'd really encourage people to consider it, students and colleagues and alike. It's absolutely fabulous. It's allowed me to do great stuff thus far. Well, I'll let you be the judge of that, but I think great research, whether or not I articulate it well is another thing. I'll let you judge. But anyway, I'll get on with this because, as ever, my problem is getting it narrowed down, having enough time to narrow this down, what I want to say. But the key thing I'm going to be talking about here is kind of a battle of words going on in the early, very early part of the conflict. I'm not going to really get on to the peace process. I'm only going to get up to the mid-80s. I can talk more about the 70s and how what may come as a surprise is actually in the mainstream American media, and this is to stress this point, mainstream media, there was a very pro-British narrative dominated. So that might be contrary to even what I thought about, you know, the influence of Irish America and so on, but in the broadsheets and television and so on, and I'm going to explain the reasons why, drawing on other people's work, why there was a very pro-British narrative interpretation of the conflict, that is, very sympathetic to the British position and what it was dealing with here, which of course was ignored then by one of the most important audiences, Irish America, who tended to, a number of, again, can't oversimplify here, but a number of would instead turn to non-mainstream media sources, more Republican-aligned outlets in terms of how they interpreted what was going on in Northern Ireland in the early 70s. So again, I'm focused on this crucial early first decade. But what I'm also going to focus on more, building on, as Graham mentioned, my work on Hume, is what led to my Fulbright project, his engagement with America going back to the late 70s, is what Hume and the Irish government were trying to do, which I've written about myself. It's very important, but I'm more focusing on how that influenced the media. I've written elsewhere about the kind of political influence, and obviously I'll mention it today because it overlaps. But it's trying to show how changing that mainstream media discourse was complementary to what Dublin and Hume were trying to do politically, which was two things. One, to counter that, you know, a very sympathetic narrative to the Republican movement, which was, of course, a huge part of funding and arms coming into the conflict and sort of fueling what was going on. But also, on the other hand, to rightly point out the errors that the British policy makers were making and the over-securitisation of the problem, etc., and to try and say that there's got to be change in British policy too. It's not just about stopping IRA violence, although that's what they led with, always, is condemning the IRA, but to say British policy's got to change too if you're going to get a solution. So there was another part of this as well, and how that, I would argue, contributes very importantly to what I'm going to finish with, the Anglo-Irish Agreement, which I would argue is really the start of the peace process. Again, you can see on my CV I've written about that elsewhere, so I won't make the case for that, but I've made it in print elsewhere that this really is the turning point in involving the Irish government. And as I say, I've got a lot to cover, so I'll gallop through it. I'm happy to come back if I'm not making sense or not clearly explaining certain points. But first of all, to outline this very pro-British consensus, and I'm drawing on Jack Holland's work here, and his book is a journalist from Belfast, emigrated to the States in the 70s, and covered Northern Ireland for a good few decades, wrote a number of books, but this one particularly had a chapter on looking at the media, so looking at what his experience, but also what, you know, actually American colleagues were writing. I suppose he had been Irish American, hadn't been there that long, but what American colleagues were writing for all the mainstream press, and the difference between the press and the TV. I'm going to be focusing more on press. And the key thing he's saying is that there was not only there was a consensus in the 1970s in the major newspapers and magazines that it was essentially the same as the British government's, and I'll explain why, or use his words too, because I'm just using his arguments here at the moment. But this was remarkably consistent until the late 70s. is the second point. And the third is that the hunger strikes really changed things. That's where I question him a little bit, because I'm saying there's a lot of stuff going on before that. And not to, he's right, the hunger strikes really do change the game. But I'm also trying to say, look at what Hume and Dublin were doing in terms of trying to influence the media from at least 76 earlier for Hume on his own. And that's important. And it kind of interacts then with the hunger strikes. But I'm, at this point, I'm drawing on what, I'm broadly agreeing with what Holland says. And to explain why he says this is, one, that very few actual correspondents were based here, or Belfast or Dublin, so coverage of Ireland, north and south, tended to be from London, because a lot more news going on there, just so for financial or whatever reasons, you know, correspondents were quite often filing their reports in London. They were bound to be influenced by the British government's, the British media's kind of take on this. People weren't coming here, okay, journalists weren't. It was a small affair in Cold War context of what's going on in the 70s in the Middle East, and, you know, as today. So it tended to be filed from London, and that had a big influence. And there's some evidence I'll come back to back him up on this. And so that the mainstream press tended to regurgitate the British media's interpretation, which was sympathetic to the British government, which is saying it's a sectarian conflict. Britain's acting as a kind of a bobby, you know, that the army's kind of holding the line between two sectarian, irrational, anachronistic tribes, and that kind of language was used. About both communities, and I'll show you some examples. So Britain's a detached, patient, objective arbiter, trying to do its best, two irrational, hate-filled communities who can't live together in harmony. And so again, I'm still drawing on Holland here. These are his quotations to just try and reinforce this point. You know, a deadly Irish quagmire, there's Newsweek, a deadly Irish quagmire, two fanatical religious armies. I mean, the point I was implying there as well, the Unionists and Nationalists are the same. They're both Irish tribes, right? So it's not exactly flattering to the Unionist community, but there's very little recognition of the Britishness and Unionists there either. It's just too... And the other thing is it's religious, right? It's seen as a sectarian, religious conflict. It's not saying it's Irish Nationalism and Ulster Unionism. The British Army here, the Boston Globe, is separating this, the combatants. These people are incapable of governing themselves. So quite, you know, kind of colonial attitude, but not just to nationalists but to unionists as well. Okay, these two warring tribes, and this was also notable in the way that quite often here the New York Times were quite often quoting British officials, because they weren't speaking to people here half as much. You know, Holland really does evidence this out, but so it was British NIO officials and Foreign Commonwealth Office officials, it was British commentators saying what the problem was, not, you know, people from Northern Ireland. And so you get this regurgitated without criticism. Too much myth in the way, history, too much history to let reason work. It's the same columnist who's speaking here, I forget who it is, actually at one point endorsed this idea of what they refer to as enlightened colonialism. You know, so it's really very, very sympathetic to the British position and saying, look, what can you do with these two communities? The British are doing their best. It's not critical at all of the British line in the very important mainstream quality press. It's very poor journalism, it's not saying the quality press at this time of what's going on, because it's very little question of the British position. It's a very, very Anglophile stance. And another reason for this is, so citing another book now, Ray O'Hanlon, also Irish-American, I suppose, I think, yeah, again, was born maybe from the South, but emigrated to the States. And a book much later on, a decade later on. But he's also giving a very good reason for this that kind of augments the thing about being in London and just the bias that's going to bring. But here's Joe Thompson, who was a journalist in the New York Times in the 80s, who was quite controversially recalled to New York then as well, after she started taking a more critical line and really asking about the shoot to kill controversies and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot more to it than that, but that I can't go into. But she's also saying how she went to London as a young journalist, delighted. You know, it's a world city, you know, and very Anglophile, as she says herself, like most Americans. Because this stress on this that might be overlooked in the focus on Irish America is how Anglophile elements of the liberal US media and so on are. And she's saying, yeah, I was an Anglophile, and look at the way they were treated. It was easy to feel well-informed. We get a special briefing at 10 Downing Street in the Foreign Commonwealth Office, invited to dinner in the best places, lovely parties. British officials were very careful to make close relationship with members of important, New York Times, the most important, news organisations. So you can see there's a very concerted effort here to try and influence American mainstream coverage, as is understandable. You know, so it's of course that the British are going to try and get their line across, but it's certainly, I wasn't so aware of just how powerful this operation was. And another way of maybe augmenting what Holland's saying is a historian, Andrew Wilson, who's written, like I aim to do, more broadly about Irish America. And he's focusing on the role of the British Information Service, based in New York. So again, this would be trying to obviously get Britain's position across on everything, trade or whatever was going on, but Northern Ireland was a big issue in the 70s and 80s. And so he's talking about the kind of huge funding as well, how much more funding, you know, how this was really beefed up in the 70s as the conflict dragged on and extended its employees. And a lot of them were just focused on Northern Ireland because this was very damaging, obviously, from a British point of view, about how this was going on, what was going on in this, you know, this conflict that people thought would be over after a few years. So you can see a lot of resources pumped into this to try and show British policy was presented in the best light. Huge mailing lists, and when British diplomats and politicians are over there, you know, kind of make sure and mention, you know, the IRA's links with other terrorist groups and leftist groups, which of course Republicans made sure to tone down in their own coverage, which I'll get onto, because of the Cold War context and Irish American Catholicism being very anti, you know, very signed up in certain regards to the anti-communist struggle and so on. So that, you know, pointing out the way that the Republicans would be trying to manipulate the agenda as well and saying, you know, stress this because that goes down well with an American audience, and particularly not even a Catholic conservative audience, to say that the IRA, you know, the kind of links that were being made with more radical groups that would be enemies of America, etc. Okay, so so it's not just in London, so it's augmenting the Holland's thesis. It's not just the importance of London here, it's what's going on in New York. An awful lot of effort and money being spent on trying to make sure there's a very sympathetic line to the British position. But of course, I would argue, and well, if I use the words of someone else here, Mike Killian working for the Chicago Tribune, saying, of course, this was very, very counterproductive when you think surely one of the main audiences is Irish America. That's where money was being collected and you know, very propagandist views being articulated, sympathetic to the provisionals. And so saying this very overt, heavy-handed attempt to sway Irish American opinion was clumsy, futile, increasingly counterproductive. Irish Americans tended to believe just the opposite of what the British would say, especially regards Northern Ireland. This was, you know, especially because it was mainly being articulated by people with English posh accents. You know, that it was like these weren't Northern Ireland voices. It wasn't, so you had these just this narrative of these two Irish tribes and the English, mainly English accents, kind of articulating this, that this was bound to not go down well in Irish America. So it was counterproductive. And of course, you know, the images of the early conflict were therefore very easy for Republicans. I'm not really going to say a lot about this because it's been much more documented. What was going on in Irish America, and how Republicans were therefore had a field day, because they were just, look, this is propaganda from the British, and here's the truth, you know, Bloody Sunday, etc. And you know, you can imagine how these images looked, and how that just wasn't believed in large sections of Irish America. It was very easy to paint this image of a colonial aggressor, right? That so this was not working very well. If the aim was, I'm sure, surely that was the point, is to try and stop support for the IRA. The most important community is there for Irish America, but a lot, you know, those who are most interested in Northern Ireland, not all of Irish America was, again, you can oversimplify about these things, those who were going to be just not believe what was coming out of the mouths of British ministers. And so it allowed No Raid, kind of sister organisation, fundraising organisation for the IRA, and its paper, The Irish People, to kind of do what the IRA and Sinn Féin and Far Block were doing here, is to just, you know, unhindered articulate a very pro-Republican, anti-colonial narrative. As I say, though, quite often dropping out some of the more radical leftist stuff. It was quite often it was just Anne Farblack's article reproduced, but cut that bit out. And certainly, you know, I'm oversimplifying in some cases, but so it's not, I'm not going in, I don't have much time to go into this because more has been written about it, so it's not to certainly be uncritical of just how biased Republicans are being, but I'm just saying you've got two voices here that are just talking past each other. And that's why what I want to talk about more, this is so important, what the Irish government do, and they're building on the efforts of John Hume, who was already doing it very early on, to say, look, first of all, you've got to stop that support and that money that's coming into Northern Ireland. And Gareth Fitzgerald is crucial to this. Once he becomes foreign minister in 73, of really taking America seriously, because you know, now seeing this conflict is not going to be over in a few years, and this and the amount of money that was an amount of American arms, easier to get arms obviously, that were involved in the conflict, this is a real problem. And what the British are saying is actually just giving no raid publicity, because they're able to exploit and turn it around with the kind of images I showed you there. So Dublin really saw the need to start having a role in this, and Fitzgerald's absolutely crucial in starting to send really good civil servants to America. Because don't forget, for a generation, Dublin's foreign policy had been focused on getting into what was then the European Community. All the best civil servants were in Brussels. So again, you have this kind of idea of how important America is for Ireland, but not so much. There was a very poor relationship in some regards with Irish America, between the Irish government and Irish America in the 70s. Fitzgerald's very important in sending over people like himself, exceptionally bright, strategic-minded people, to say, this is a really important problem, we need to start countering it. And they work with Hume. What Hume was already doing, which was cultivating a relationship with the very top, most influential Irish politicians, so I've written about this elsewhere, repeating a little bit here, just to show that obviously there's a political side here, getting Ted Kennedy, Tip O'Neill, House Speaker, so very, very important politician, Daniel Moynihan, Hugh Carey, known as the Four Horsemen, four most senior, influential Irish-American politicians in the late 70s, to start to say the same thing, condemning all violence, but you know, making very clear, do not donate money to the IRA, and continually saying that every year, and then following that up with, Britain's got to change its policy too. Okay, but also trying to show Irish America can be helpful to the British, you work with us. You know, and it also meant that it was easy for the White House to work with this. So you get the statement from Cards, which I argue, again, along with a former PhD student, Alison Marr, we published an article that's just out there recently in Diplomatic History about the Carter Initiative. I can't go into it here, but it's a really important start. It's the first time a president's saying, in a very watered-down way, Britain's got to change its policy too. You know, it's condemning all the violence, don't donate, but it's kind of having that political traction now that even the White House was saying, okay, yeah, we can work with this. It's not just, you know, a very, you know, pro-Republican narrative, which even the horsemen themselves, until Hume comes along and says, look, it's not that simple. It's not, you know, the way Irish America has tended to see it. So they are very important in signing up to what Hume and the Fitzgerald Foreign Office, Department of Foreign Affairs is practically writing a statement for them. Again, and I'm not oversimplifying that, they are saying, say this. Okay, it's people like Hume and Michael Lillis who are writing those statements, and it's the same thing then repeated, becoming more critical of the British government because there's no movement by the British government as things go on, but they're saying the same thing from the late 70s, don't support the IRA, London needs to change too. And this is where I start to talk more about the kind of civil servants who were very important in this. I interviewed Ted Smith, who was, so he's an example of one of these very, very bright, and they tended to be quite young, but, you know, really remarkably young, you know, who had maybe a very, very different perspective on this. People like Michael Lillis, Sean Donnan, who was Irish ambassador before he was 40, really, really bright people who were very much in line with what Hume and Fitzgerald were saying. And so Smith was like kind of a media, you know, real PR, spin doctor, whatever the modern parlance would be, so based in New York with the media centre, and huge Irish, that's where a lot of the debate is because of the huge Irish American community there, and saying how important Hume was, and not just that, it was so getting on, not just it's Hume's agreed Ireland policy, which lots of people will be critical of, it's about how vague it was, but also it's that key, how he's stressing how positive it was, this idea that this was And don't forget, this is 10 years into the conflict, right? So for a long time, American journalists have heard this narrative of the IRA victory. This is the year of victory, and the British saying it's under control. You know, terrorists are defeated. And 10 years on, it's the same thing. So a lot of journalists are turning off at this point. And here's Hume coming along with this, look, there is a way forward. This isn't an intractable conflict. It's about respecting the two identities and all that kind of discourse that I've written elsewhere about. So most people will be familiar with it. If you're not, I've written a book on it. But he shows how that was very persuasive to journalists who were tired of it, who were tuning out of the conflict, because there's far more important stuff going on in a global context from a journalist's point of view. That's not from people in Northern Ireland, but saying, look, that's insoluble. Here's Hume saying, it is soluble, but the British government needs to change policy and Irish-American needs to stop seeing it in this romantic way. So he had a very clear message, and as Smith is saying, he was the ace card. You know, he was very, very articulate, persuasive in his manner. He was speaking, he was from here, he was from the front line. You know, bloody something happened in his constituency, so he had authority and authenticity, and that gave journalists hope, and it gave, this was someone who knew what it was like, who was from the box office, right, who really knew and understood this mentality, and was saying, Republicans are not right, and neither are the British government, and both need to change. So there's a picture of Smith, and he's also saying, crucially, about this, again, I said that there'll be critics, particularly units, of how vague the concept is, but at its heart, this Agreed Ireland thing about saying, look, you've got to recognise the two identities. It's not about simply United Ireland. It's not about simply a British Northern Ireland. So he's saying, look, this was a good way of kind of outmanoeuvring those narratives, of saying, look, with all due respect, one side saying we want it to be Irish, another British, will say, well, hang on, it's both. Right, you've got to recognise both identities. And that continued message, which people got very sick of Hume saying, but it's kind of like, look at the Anglo-Irish Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, it's all there, that's what it is, parity of esteem, as it comes later on. And that core message made sense. People got this philosophically and intellectually. You know, so this is why Hume was really important in his message. I'm stressing Hume here, going back to some of what I've said before, because he's really giving Dublin a policy. Because don't forget, at this stage, formerly Dublin is still pro-United Ireland. That creates a problem when it's trying to deal with no raid, right? Well, hang on, you know, you're contradictory. So Dublin, I'll get back to that point about Dublin's policy, but here's just proof that, you know, journalists were being persuaded. So very important, senior columnist for the New York Times, saying Hume persuaded a lot of us. And so he's not quite the same way there, but you know, there's a positive message. You know, people were looking to the future for their children. Reconciliation depended on granting political rights, recognising nationalist unionists and so on, and having a voice in the future. So he's not using exactly the terms of power sharing, right? You know, British, Irish dimension and power sharing. But you know, he's showing that kind of impact that Hume, you know, maybe in a filtered way, but it's a much more like what Dublin and Hume are saying you've got to do, which is recognise the two traditions and give everyone a fair say. So that was starting to persuade some journalists who otherwise had tuned out. Things get set back terribly. Things are terribly set back in this more progressive project that Hume and Dublin are involved in by the hunger strikes, of course. It gets just polarised again, particularly in America. And the world over, obviously, this is noting, but going back to Holland, this is why he thinks the hunger strikes are a turning point. He's right, because referring to the idea that journalists weren't coming here, they certainly came in 1981, right? Because this was like, it's hard to get your head around, and just how it would have, you know, from a media point of view, the appeal of it, you know, people successively starving themselves to death and, you know, getting elected into Parliament. It was a sensational story on that front, you know. If you step back from the horrors and the violence and everything else that's going on. So the world media did come to Belfast for a short period and did start to go, hang on a minute. And Thatcher in her very, very hard-line stance, you know, Dublin was obviously trying to say, look, yes, you can't concede the full status, but, you know, could there be some kind of, grant some concessions about what actually happened after the hunger strike. Of course, Thatcher was never going to give in while the hunger strikes were on, and so she played into this very, you know, as the Iron Lady, and she's not going to bend. You know, so this was hugely appealing to the media, and therefore a huge boost to Republicans again, you know, to no rights funding, jumps back up again. It had been dipping down in the late 70s because of the message getting through to Irish America of going, this is not funding just a glorious struggle against British occupation and all that. It's a very bloody, sectarian, horrible conflict. But it jumps back up in the just because it looks again like these hunger strikers and the echoes that has in Irish history and the precursors, 1916, etc. What's really interesting, though, is what people like Ted Smith... I was astounded by the stuff I was reading then, that he was writing. This document, actually, that he gave me a copy of, it's before the hunger strikes... Okay, it's at the tail end, but it's before the hunger strikes are over, so this has had a hugely repolarising impact. But Smith, who's in New York, where a lot of the real protests from Irish America was going on outside the British consulate and so on, huge protests when Charles and Diane visit, etc. And he's kind of like remarkably positive in this report that he's writing. So I'm saying, hang on, look, the quality press, and this is the other thing to stress, not the TV. TV was all the hunger strikes and the romanticisation or the tragedy and the kind of theatre of it, or however you want to term it. But he's saying, look, the quality press has started to change. And I'll give examples in a minute. And they're starting to reframe the problem as being about true identities, not about religion. Because, of course, the hunger strikes and kind of Christ-like images and that kind of conjured back up some of those very, you know, more mythical and sectarian and inexplicable and romantic or, you know, whatever, you know, the struggle, all these kind of less rational forces, right? So Smith's saying, look, there are journalists now who are writing about this, actually engaging with the reality. There's politics going on here, okay? And this is very remarkable. So for me, anyway, I'm emphasising, the Washington Post, this is like the day after Sanders is elected. And instead of the kind of sensational stuff that you got on TV, it's quite nuanced. Who in Britain needs a reminder that the Catholic minority demands a different order? And it's, like, if I could extend the quote, that you're saying, there's got to be political change here. So it's not accepting this idea that Thatcher's saying they're just criminals. It's kind of saying, yeah, well, you know, it's condemning the hunger strikers and Sands and what they're in principle, but it's also saying, look, clearly the nationalist community, they're not going to be reconciled to the union. Okay, so it's kind of what probably some British policymakers and advisors are saying to Thatcher, although she's not listening at that point, saying you're going to have to engage the reality of the problem, you're going to have to deal with Dublin. And what's the LA Times say? It's saying some form of dual nationality with links to Dublin and London. Chicago Tribune, work harder with the Irish government for a negotiated solution. New York Times, convincing Ulster Protestants that they can accept some form of political association with the Republic without sacrificing their religious freedom or British identity. A lot of this is a lot more like what Hume and the Irish government are saying, this idea of going, it's not going to be United Ireland, but the Irish government's got to be involved because the nationalist community, clearly Irish, you know, the British government cannot reconcile it to the Union, cannot represent it, and that even possibly SDLP voters at this time are going, yeah, I'll vote because of, you know, just pure frustration or to thinking they might have to save Sam's life or whatever it is, but to say politics doesn't seem to be working. You're going to have to recognise these are not going to accept British citizenship. It's not just about religion, and it's not just about socioeconomic rights, well, it's about nationalisms. So Smith's kind of looking at this and saying, look, there's a change here, okay? And it's not just the hunger strikes have created this overnight, this is more reflective media. And that's why he's happy. He's kind of thinking, you know, they've been trailing around these editorial boards right across the states for the last 4 or 5 years, and they can see. He's writing this report for his political masters in Dublin and saying, it's working. You know, things look really bad right now. They looked very bad at that time, right? But Smith was very optimistic of what he was saying. He'd be like, hang on, there's a change in the debate in America already. And I sort of come back to this thing about Dublin's policy because, of course, formally it's still pro-United Ireland. Rather than this more vague, but I would argue useful, agreed Ireland. And that's really what the New Ireland Forum is about. It's about getting particularly Mr. Haughey to kind of sign up to this more nuanced, progressive ideal of an agreed Ireland. Again, it's more complex than I can go into here. well, you know, Fitzgerald and the Labour Party were far more sympathetic to these ideas. It was about trying to bring in Fianna Fáil and say, look, we've got to become more nuanced about what we mean by Irish unity. You know, let's talk about that, a sense of unity, not just a traditional United Ireland. And it was very clearly a PR effort as well. Look at there's Hume's opening speech. The world is looking at this forum today. They must see we mean business. For those of you not familiar with it, this was like a very important, you know, went on for months longer than people thought because there were so many disagreements. You know, I would argue this is the first serious effort of the Irish state to really consider its own role in the problem. Okay, and I think the best example of this is the way the Catholic Church is really questioned here as well. People overlook how important this was, that this was the first time you had the Irish establishment really sitting down and saying to the bishops, to the hierarchy, we're going to have to change the constitution. And of course, they're defending no, you know, because of the huge influence they'd had in the constitution. It's the first time the Irish establishment is seriously sitting across from the Catholic Church and questioning it. And don't forget, this is the early 80s. And that was seen by world opinion. So you can see what Hume is saying, let no one doubt its impact on British and international opinion. This is very clearly trying to show that we constitutional nationalists are trying to be constructive. Doesn't mean it was perfect, doesn't mean there's still very traditionalist elements in that, and not least because Haughey was saying, no, that's staying in, we're still going to bang on about United Ireland here. But you can see there's real progress there in terms of saying, look, we've got to recognise British identity of unionists. And there's a kind of a clear edging towards clearer the principle of consent. Again, Haughey kind of messed it up a bit in the word, compromising on the wording. But they're trying to move towards those elements of what becomes the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. And it did, therefore, win international support. You know, very sympathetic responses. And in the British media, the liberal media, but, you know, in France, Germany, America, America most crucially, are saying, look, constitutional nationalists are really trying to engage the reality of the problem here and trying to show that they've got a way forward that's about recognising the two identities, etc. In essence, Hume's kind of agreed Ireland strategy. Which really looks like it's not going to work when you have this quite famous incident where Thatcher responds to the more simplistic options of, you know, federal, united, or joint sovereignty Ireland, Northern Ireland, saying that is out. There's this very famous, and obviously you need to probably see it on TV, and Thatcher's, you know, always was that kind of very forceful, but I think particularly she was annoyed with the way the questions were, but it came across very, very stern. But it was like, it seemed like this was a blanket dismissal of the New Ireland Forum report. That is out. I told you, that kind of tone that came across, which really was very damaging to Fitzgerald after all these months. As I said, it went on for like the best part of 2 years. At this time, all these efforts had been put in to get this agreed report and trying to drag Haughey to a more nuanced line on unity. And Thatcher just seems to be dismissing it completely. And the Irish press were really, really, you know, this was a really humiliating moment for Fitzgerald. Haughey was destroying him in Dáil Éireann. You know, this is a national humiliation because he didn't respond to Thatcher. I'll explain why in a minute. Or actually, I'll let Fitzgerald, he's saying, look, regardless of the short-term humiliation, in remaining silent, he concluded the best thing was to ignore what had been said there. If there's more to it that I can go into in here, as well as kind of a misinterpretation of certain what was said and whatever, but, well, Fitzgerald argues, but it was pretty bad from Dublin's point of view. But where Fitzgerald was pretty astute was to say, look, there's nothing to be gained by me kind of coming out and saying, like a lot of his advisors saying, look, you're going to have to stand up here and say, this is, you know, unacceptable, that, you know, we've made a serious effort here. He just let it go. And thinking that opinion would turn around, this helpful reaction, I believe, that the debacle would evoke in Britain, and it did. Even the Guardian and so on, obviously, was like, this is a serious constructive effort by nationalists, you know, read some of the more positive things I'm stressing and saying, look, he saw this reaction that might help get negotiations back on track, because it looked at this point, this very famous meeting, nobody thought there was going to be an Anglo-Irish agreement 12 months on from that, because it looked like Thatcher was saying, no, there will be no Dublin involvement in Northern Ireland. It looked like her traditional line. And so unionists obviously hugely celebrated this, and it was a very, very, very tricky moment for the Fitzgerald government, because it had spent so long trying to get some progress on Northern Ireland at a time when the economy was in dire straits, and sad. So Fitzgerald was under a lot of pressure, and he decided not to respond. Instead, and here again I'm jumping a bit because just to try and cram in the essence of what I'm trying to say, it's just notable that this comes a month later, Thatcher's in Washington. So November 1984, a month later, Thatcher's in Washington, and obviously the Irish embassy has been working overtime to say, look, we've had this really constructive effort, and Thatcher's dismissed it in this very, very, very stern way. And so look at the response. And now I'm drawing on actual White House files, Fulbright again, huge thanks to, I was able to go to the Reagan archive. And so look at what a White House advisor is saying to Reagan here, to say to Thatcher that I must, specifically referencing that November summit, he's advising Reagan, saying, I must tell you frankly, the public perception in America of the outcome of the November summit was not favourable. More importantly, I would argue, is what the State Department has said, because it's for Dublin and everyone else, from kind of any Republican certainly, but even Dublin, see this is very Anglophile, you know, that it's because of the Cold War special relationship, etc. But here, even the State Department is saying this is not good, right? Thatcher's very stiff public comments. She's trying to give a more upbeat gloss. Thatcher did realise, I think, some of the damage she'd done. She realised that she really harmed Fitzgerald. And but he's saying you should tell her, again, this is very specifically saying what Reagan should say to her when he meets her, that we, the Americans, are concerned unless there is the appearance of progress, just make it look better. And the next summit, there could be a radicalisation of Irish American opinion that could endanger our current bipartisan policy in Congress. And it's not like Reagan needed the State Department to tell him, although I'm saying that's very important, the State Department saying this, saying, look, you're going to have to be critical of Thatcher here. And don't forget, Reagan didn't open his mouth about the hunger strikes. He's never going to publicly criticise Thatcher, though Irish America really wanted him to. But here, he's going to say something, and he did. Like, I'm just saying, more noting the advice that was given to him. So this was a topic of conversation at this summit, which was obviously about, you know, the Middle East and the Cold War and Star Wars was that era, and this new emerging Soviet premier, Mr. Gorbachev. You know, there was far more importance. This was that Northern Ireland was only a very small part of this, but it was very notable. The president was saying, ah, you know, that summit that's kind of a problem for us because Tip O'Neill, House Speaker, so therefore very important in Reagan getting the rest of his legislation through. Had written, in fact, two letters to Reagan running up to this meeting. One as House Speaker, one as co-chair, I think he was, of the Friends of Ireland group. So the first one, him as House Speaker, stressing his deep concern that the forum, which is the best hope for a peaceful, lawful, constitutional resolution of this tragedy, is in serious jeopardy as a result of Thatcher's public statements. Very specifically focused on how... So it's this media perception of, like, you know, that there's been a really constructive effort by Irish nationalists, and if Thatcher is not checked on this, it's going to destroy constitutional nationalist efforts, because Republicans, like unionists, are having a field day with this. Fitzgerald is humiliated, and Haughey using this politically, and as are Sinn Féin, saying, look, what can constitutional nationalism do? Nothing. Okay, so it's very clear saying, this is a real danger here, what Thatcher's done. And the second letter, which was then co-signed by Ted Kennedy, as I said, letterbacks, O'Neill is arguably more important at this time, but not just Democrats. Friends of Ireland group, this is where they were very strategic, they're now a Republican White House, that getting Irish American Republicans as well, and there were a lot more in the Reagan era, right? Irish Americans starting to vote for more for the Republicans. So getting a bipartisan Friends of Ireland group to, you know, 42 members of Congress to say, to praise the forum and question Thatcher's preemptory dismissal of its proposals. So Reagan knew before just that, but when you got all of this advice, the same thing, his White House advisors, the State Department, and of course Tip O'Neill, trying to create problems for him and saying, look, this is bang out of order. Thatcher's got to be turned around on this because it's going to just fuel the conflict. And if constitutional nationalism can't be seen to have some purchase on this. And so it's very notable, therefore, that Fitzgerald in his memoirs says that January 1985, after Christmas, after that meeting, so, you know, November, December, January, suddenly the British come back with, okay, yeah, there's going to be, it's really is the essence of the Anglo-Irish Agreement. Okay, there's a lot more the fine points of it. But the essence of the Anglo-Irish Agreement is there in the proposals the British come back with in January 1985. But as challenging as it was for Fitzgerald those couple of months, it seemed quite a shrewd move to just shut his mouth and to instead to try and use the kind of purchase that had been built up in Irish America. And he's there specifically saying political media reaction in Ireland and Britain, and especially the US, was such that a major review of the British position was undertaken during the Christmas break, and in January they came forward with a new approach, which is basically what the Irish, which Fitzgerald had long been on. Not as much as the Irish wanted. You know, Fitzgerald was still hoping for something much closer to joint authority. So I'm not saying this is just simply a victory for constitutional nationalism or what Fitzgerald's after, but it's at least now Thatcher seems to have been persuaded, and there were key advisors around her saying this as well, you're going to have to work with Dublin. Dublin's going to have a say in Northern Ireland. There's not going to be stability unless you do this, which I would argue is the real turning point in the process, in the conflict. So it's amazing that 12 months on from that disastrous summit at the November 1985 one was at Ellsborough, and you get the Ellsborough or Anglo-Irish Agreement, which, as I say, I've written elsewhere, I think is really the most important agreement. It's because it's fundamental. It's a precursor to the Good Friday Agreement. It starts the two governments actually trying to resolve the problem instead of megaphone diplomacy. It's a real turning point, but I'll come back and defend that if need be. But I hopefully am persuading you of the point that America's got a big role in this. Now, very briefly, am I right for time, Graham?
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah. So just again, to give you a sense of how tuned in the American media, the broadsheets are to this, having tuned out in the late 70s. Look at the kind of welcome this gets. Boston Globe, the involvement of Dublin, makes this a historic moment, first attempt to heal the divisions of 64 years ago, since partition. The Chicago Tribune, first meaningful British move towards a workable settlement of the Ulster question. So all of these things, I think, are quite prescient. You know, this was truly, truly historic, and it was, there's a lot more violence, and a lot, it's very destabilising for a period. The flag protests were nothing compared to the Anglo-Irish Agreement protests, but it was showing there's not going to be a reconstitutional storm on a majoritarian basis. If the two communities can't power share, then London and Dublin will. You know, that's why it was so important. I think most notably as well as here is Mary McGrory, who was one of the kind of leading female journalists at the time, who was saying, and she always had the inside track, obviously the name would suggest Irish-American background. I think she was quite close to the Kennedys, because I think she might have been covering the Bobby Kennedy's campaign as a very young journalist when he was killed, and she was very close to Ethel Kennedy. So she always had the inside track on these things, and she reported as well that apparently Thatcher and Fitzgerald had rehearsed their post-summit statements to avoid any unnecessary offence. It's a clear reference to the disaster of 12 months ago, where, I didn't go into the detail there, there were two separate conferences, and Fitzgerald was on the way to the Dublin Embassy. He hadn't heard what Thatcher said, so he looked even more ridiculous, because the journalists were all saying, ouch, what's, this is... And he kind of was like, he didn't know what had been said. So if you do read his memoirs, it's more to it than what I'm saying, and clearly there was a recognition by Thatcher as well of going, right, I kind of need you as well. I don't want to harm you. I don't want to boost Fianna Fáil opposition. And she knew the damage she'd done to Fitzgerald, and this was about trying to show now, which I would argue is crucial to the peace process, London and Dublin are on the same page. Clearly the opposite of what we've got now and all the tensions that creates. That's what was so successful, is get from the Anglo-Irish Agreement onwards, is you had that increasing alignment. Never perfect, but they gradually saw each other's perspective a lot more. Okay, so you can see that very positive reaction from the press. And I'm not saying, of course, the press is the crucial actor here. If we're going to say what is most important about America's role, it's the White House, right? It's Reagan saying, Margaret, we're going to have to show out Northern Ireland now. That's what's really important. But I'm saying that you've got to see that the context in which it comes, which is that there's a change in the broader debate about Northern Ireland in America. That now even the State Department is kind of saying, yeah, you have to work with O'Neill and Kennedy because we need them. They're doing the British a favour with the British press always see it. They don't, quite often the right-wing press, Kennedy and O'Neill are IRA apologists. No, they're criticising the IRA. You need them on side. And if you don't, then, raid, etc., is just going to get more funding. So the State Department even now, so it's that trying to change that broader debate, because for a long time Irish America has wanted the White House to say this, but the White House wouldn't. Now that it's liberal, not just Irish American opinion, not just Irish American journalists, but just American mainstream quality commentators are saying, yeah, Dublin's really trying to work with this, you need to work with them. All of that helped. And it all helped, it goes back further to what, you know, what the Four Horsemen and what becomes the Friends of Ireland, as the group broadens out and involves Republicans, is trying to say, which is very clearly condemning all violence, don't donate to the IRA, but as well, London has got to move. You cannot have an unqualified union. You cannot have a solely British Northern Ireland. You've got to have something of what the New Ireland Forum was saying, something of that agreed Ireland model. You've got to recognise that nationalists are nationalists, they're Irish, and there's got to be some representation for Dublin for that. Ideally, power sharing, but if you can't have it, then Dublin at least acts as a spokesperson for them. So that what I'm saying is, by the mid-80s, the US press was not just focused on, and I stress press here as opposed to media, not just focused, because the TV was always different as well, and Smith made that clear in saying it's getting the press that's read in the White House and the State Department. They're not just reporting now on the latest tragedy or bloodletting. They're not uncritically regurgitating London's line on the conflict. They're now very questioning of the hunger strikes and Thatcher's intransigence, and particularly very questioning of Thatcher's response to the New Ireland Forum. And instead, I found this amazing. The New York Times printed verbatim the Anglo-Irish agreement. I don't know, and I've not come across any British paper doing that. You know, I thought that, because it's quite a, you know, like all these agreements are, you know, there's a lot of policing cooperation, all this kind of, you know, so I don't, you know, I'm not saying everyone read this, but that's how, you know, how much more open, you know, you can see why the press reports on the hunger strikes or on the fall of Sunningdale or whatever else is tragic, but to report this, you know, very dry text is showing how invested a number of journalists were now in this, trying to say this is good, this is the Anglo-Irish, this is a real step forward, probably more so than some of the British media at that time. But there were very significant, important outlets, New York Times the most important, that were engaging with what was going on, but not engaging from a sensationalist point of view of going, look at the hunger strikes, look at the myth and religion and 400, 500 years, same old thing. It's kind of saying, look at this joint sovereignty, look at this radical idea of saying it's not completely British and involving the Irish government, and trying to explain to its readers, this is a good idea. It's very hard to get your head around, because don't forget at that time, things didn't look good. 1985, and it's trying to say, this is really good. This is really a breakthrough. This is historical. This is important. And Irish America and everyone else in America, and even the Anglophiles, if you care about Britain, you know, you should care about this hopeful endeavour. And that's the way it was presented. But I'll leave it at that, and hopefully I haven't gone on too long or been confusing and trying to get across everything I wanted to. And I'm happy, of course, to try and clarify any points. But thank you very much for your time. And
thank you.